Senator John Walsh's campaign says the Montana Democrat will not drop out of the U.S. Senate race. That is our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Good evening, I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates-Kearney. A University of Montana political science professor tells Edward O'Brien that Walsh will have a tough time overcoming reports of past plagiarism. And Flathead reporter Catherine Fry tells us about a firearms manufacturing course at Flathead Valley Community College.
Senator John Walsh's campaign says the Montana Democrat won't drop out of November's election over allegations that he plagiarized a research project required for a master's degree. Walsh has come under fire amid reports that his 2007 U.S. Army War College thesis included a series of unattributed passages taken from the writings of other scholars. Asked if Walsh was considering dropping out of the race, campaign spokeswoman Lauren Pasalacqua said today, quote, "Absolutely not." National and state Democrats reaffirmed their support of the embattled senator's candidacy. That includes Montana Governor Steve Bullock, who said he had no knowledge of the plagiarism when he appointed the former lieutenant governor to the state to the Senate in February. Walsh faces Republican U.S. Representative Steve Daines in the November 4th election.
Both Daines and Walsh campaigns declined our interview request today. University of Montana Associate Professor of Political Science Rob Saladin has been following this story and visited with Edward O'Brien today about the latest developments. O'Brien opened the conversation by mentioning a fundraising email issued by the Walsh campaign just yesterday morning.
And at the very top, highlighted in yellow, it says, new poll. According to public policy polling, John Walsh has gained 10 points on his opponent and considerably tightened this race. We can win in Montana. And then click here to donate today. How would you characterize the Daines-Walsh race at this point in the summer lull prior to this story breaking?
Well, I think there are two things that are worth noting prior to this New York Times story. First, Walsh was always in a little bit of a tough position. He's running as a Democrat in a pretty red state, a state that Romney carried by, I think, 18 points. He's up against a solid, well-known, and popular opponent in Steve Daines. And he's running at a difficult time for Democrats. He's got an unpopular second-term Democrat in the White House. It's just not a good time to be running as a Democrat. Republicans ran into this same type of challenge at this point in the Bush presidency. So the fundamentals were always in favor of Daines, but the Walsh campaign did seem to be going better than expected, maybe much better than expected. You mentioned that latest poll showed only a 7-point difference, right? This indicated major momentum for Walsh. And so I think a lot of people looked at this and thought, gosh, this is really shaping up to be a much tighter race than the fundamentals would indicate that it should be, and hopes and expectations were raised for Democrats, and I think there were some people who were increasingly worried on the Republican side.
What do you think explains that boost?
Well, I think you look at some of the ads coming out of the Walsh campaign. He's been very aggressive on the attack against Daines, hitting women's issues especially, and it looks like some of those attacks against Daines appeared to be gaining traction. And then you also take in some of the unique aspects of Walsh as a candidate, his background as a veteran, and other things. And, maybe it looked like Walsh was going to be perhaps the type of Democrat who could be successful, even in a fairly red conservative state like Montana.
Okay, let's hop back in the time machine, go after the New York Times plagiarism story broke. In the hours since that's happened, I've had a few conversations, just casual conversations with Missoulians I know, people who are liberal Missoula Democrats, and proudly so. And the conversations I've had, these people are angry, openly angry about this. So my question to you, Rob, would be, if Senator Walsh has ticked off the party's bread-and-butter base, what sort of an uphill climb does he have to get those all-important independents?
I think it's a devastating thing for his campaign. I mean, if he doesn't have the liberal base, I don't think there's any chance for him. I mean, he's got to be able to maintain those people. And the problem is, if he loses the liberal base, it's going to hurt him with independents too. So I think this is just a devastating thing. I mean, if he loses the liberal base, it's all over.
What do you make of this response of his, that he was dealing with PTSD after his service in Iraq, unintentionally made some incorrect citations, and he'll consider apologizing to the scholars for lifting his work? It seems to me it's a combination of humility and almost defiance all at once. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it's a very poor response. Given what's come out, I guess I'm not entirely sure what else he can say. But this is a crippling charge. It totally undermines his credibility. The plagiarism is obvious, it's blatant, and it's massive in scope. It's the kind of thing that as a teacher, I would consider scandalous and entirely unacceptable for an 18-year-old undergraduate student fresh out of high school. And it's, of course, much worse in Walsh's case. This was his master's thesis, which is the culmination and primary product of his graduate work. He keeps referring to it as a term paper to seemingly to try to minimize the importance of a master's thesis. But the master's thesis is the big deal when you're in a graduate program. It's also difficult because this is not something that can be passed off as some kind of youthful indiscretion. This is, after all, something that just happened a few years ago. And in terms of his statement that he was going through some difficult times, PTSD and other things, I think a lot of people can understand that and certainly take that into account. But you look at this instance of plagiarism, and it's maybe worth saying that plagiarism, there can be some gray areas around plagiarism. It's not always totally clear-cut. But this is as clear-cut as it gets. It's black and white. Again, it's massive in scope. And so the thought that this was just a few errors at the margins, I don't think it plays well at all. And it's just not a very compelling explanation.
This race has always been described as one of the key races to control of the U.S. Senate. And the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has come out standing by Senator Walsh right now. Is that surprising, do you think?
No, I don't think it's surprising. I think they'll probably wait and see how this plays out. You know, there have been some other senators who've had charges like this brought against them. Rand Paul fairly recently and Joe Biden going back a few decades. But those were really different cases. Those were basically those senators taking a few words and inserting them into their speeches. I think this is a much bigger thing because it's his master's thesis, right, which is the basis for one of his main credentials. That being said, I mean, I think it's not surprising that Democrats are standing by him, hoping that this will blow over and go away. Whether it does or not, I think is a totally separate question, but it certainly doesn't surprise me that Democrats back in Washington and here in Montana, at least publicly, are sticking with him at this point.
Mm. I know this is one of those silly conjecture questions, but do you think the senator could bow out and be replaced, or would that just be a complete blow to the party?
I think Democrats in Montana and in Washington have to be thinking about that exact question right now. The difficulty is that Walsh was about number 10 on the list of candidates that Democrats wanted to run for this seat. Brian Schweitzer, most prominently, declined to run. A number of statewide officials declined to run. The entire Williams family seemingly declined to run. And so it's not entirely clear what the plan B would be right now. There's nobody necessarily waiting in the wings to step into that post. And so that may mean that Democrats stick with Walsh and indeed encourage Walsh to stay in the race.
Last question, Rob, and that is dealing with Governor Bullock. He appointed Walsh back in February, says he didn't know about this plagiarism, but is standing by his guy. Do you think the governor could get hit with this political shrapnel?
I guess I don't. I certainly hope he doesn't. I think this is something that it would have been difficult for Bullock to unearth, and my sense is that the governor should not be blamed for this. This entirely falls on Walsh's head.
I've been speaking with Rob Saldine, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Montana. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Ed.
In other news from around the state, the Sear Gulch fire, which was first reported yesterday afternoon, continues to burn in the Deep Creek area on the west side of the Clark Fork River near Missoula. The Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation, as well as local firefighters, constructed fire lines that held the fire in check overnight. Public Relations Specialist Jordan Copen confirms the fire was started by a lightning strike and is about 15% contained.
Yeah, we have three helicopters that are staging for our fire. They haven't been dropping any buckets because we haven't needed that. We are concerned slightly about the winds, but not too bad because the cooler temperatures, which have allowed us to knock down the fire pretty good. Yesterday, the helicopters did a really good job, along with the air tanker and the air show that we had going on yesterday.
The wind has pushed the fire and it's burning about 48 acres so far, but Copen says fire crews will be taking advantage of today's lower temperatures and increased humidity.
Definitely today is an important day. It is supposed to be hot and dry by the weekend. So we know that we have a lot of good workers on the ground right now, and they're doing a really good job. All that we're asking the public is to keep, you know, kind of clear of that deep creek area so our operations can run smoothly. Other than that, things are open.
Copen says a second fire spotted south of the Sear Gulch, known as the Hagerty Fire, has been completely contained. He says that fire was also started by a lightning strike.
Police and the Missoula County Sheriff's Office are investigating after a man's body was found in the Clark Fork River in Missoula. Passersby reported seeing the body in the water east of the California Street footbridge at about 7 o'clock last night. Officers say the man was a 60-year-old Missoula resident. His name hasn't been released. Missoula County Sheriff's spokeswoman Paige Pavlone says investigators are still trying to determine the cause of death.
How to train a workforce for the gun-making industry is a question the Flathead Valley Community College is trying to answer. Katrin Fry reports the college has been offering various gunsmith classes, but starting this fall, they'll have a 4-credit firearms manufacturing certificate course.
Flathead Valley Community College instructor Sam Hatfield is teaching a gunsmith course on the Army Marksmanship Unit method of rebuilding a 1911 handgun.
We take it completely down and we're actually rebuilding the firearm itself. We take everything that was done at the factory and we blueprint it and we rebuild it to within a fraction of a thousandth of an inch.
Hatfield says this helps with the firearm's mechanical accuracy. Next door is a checkering class taught by Lee Helgeland,
which is a series of lines cut one at a time at about that angle.
Students are using a small etching tool to carve out a crisscross diamond-shaped pattern along the wooden body of their rifles.
Historically, it was for grip, for traction with your hand, as opposed to a smooth surface, which is slippery. The original idea was to make it rough for more friction for your hand. So it has a function, and like many things on here, we try to also have the design we like or the looks we like.
These are among several National Rifle Association non-credit gunsmith courses coordinated at FVCC by Fred Zeglin.
Basically, the NRA put it together many, many years ago, and the idea was to allow hobbyists and professionals to extend their skills and grow as an individual.
Zeglin says only 5 schools in the country offer these courses. This fall, he'll be taking on a new position as program coordinator for the college's new firearms certificate. He says this program is tied to the school's computer-assisted CNC manufacturing program.
And the idea behind it is to train people not so much to be gunsmiths, but to have firearms technology background so that when they go to work for a manufacturer making parts or accessories for the firearms trade, that they'll understand how those parts interrelate with the firearm. And if there is a problem, they can say, well, I know from my experience that fitting this product in a certain way will improve the way it works or maybe fix a problem that has been insurmountable for a manufacturer.
Zeglin says there are about 15 gun manufacturers in the Flathead, and he spoke with a number of them about what they're looking for.
They're not looking for gunsmiths. They're looking for machinists who have a good understanding of firearms. So the program is designed around that concept. What we want to do is teach the systems of firearms. So we'll go through a number of different guns, but it's not so much the specific gun that we want them to learn as it is how the mechanics of that firearm work.
Zeglin says there are special things about firearms, like the high pressures internally at which they operate. He says there are a number of gunsmith programs across the country, but he says this is the only one focusing on the concept of manufacturing and firearms systems.
All the other programs are designed around the idea of general gunsmithing, teaching repair, and most guys who take those classes are interested in hanging their shingle out as a gunsmith and being that independent person, whereas this class is really designed for guys who want to be a machinist and work in the firearms technology business.
The Firearms Technology Certificate at FVCC starts this fall. It's a one-year, 27-credit certificate with room for 12 to 16 students. Applications to the program are due August 1st. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
In tonight's forecast, a wind advisory is in effect until midnight tonight for the Kootenai Cabinet region, west and eastern glacier regions, the Flathead Mission Valleys, northern Rocky Mountain Front, and Toole. Across our listening area, tonight should be mostly clear with lows in the upper 30s to mid-40s. Tomorrow should be sunny with highs 70 to 80. And now for the editorial comments of Bonnie Lorang.
Friends told you that they cannot get a hold of you on your phone? Did they say the phone rang and rang and rang and no one answered? Or maybe they said they heard a series of beeps or just dead air. Yet you know you were home all evening and the telephone never rang. Maybe you're a business owner experiencing an unusual drop in the number of incoming long-distance calls. Perhaps you notice odd numbers on your caller ID or a pattern of malfunctioning faxes. These are all symptoms of a practice that has plagued rural consumers and rural telephone companies across the country for too long. The Federal Communications Commission, FCC, identifies this problem as call completion. Simply put, it means that the long-distance calls or wireless calls intended for you don't get to you. This practice threatens the integrity of the nation's telecommunications network. It jeopardizes public safety. It affects our daily lives. It puts consumers at risk. Rural telephone companies have been battling this nemesis for a number of years. State and federal regulators have expressed their frustration and have taken some steps to try to curtail the problem, but it is still here. The call completion issue can be largely traced to a practice called least cost routing. Long distance and wireless companies transit calls over a series of roads or routes connecting multiple intermediate points and facilities. Some of these providers hand off calls destined for rural areas to whatever other provider offers them the lowest price. They hand off the call via the route of the least cost. In many cases, these intermediate providers fail to route or transit the call to the ultimate destination. Rural subscribers may receive calls of poor quality, or they may not receive the calls at all. A number of Montana's local telephone companies have participated in nationwide test call studies to determine the extent of the call completion problem across Montana and in rural America. How effectively are long-distance companies delivering the calls intended for rural telephone subscribers? The survey results are telling, and these are national numbers. In 2011, 24% of the long-distance calls placed to rural test areas were delayed, of poor quality, or incomplete. The 2012 study indicated the problems continued or worsened in 62% of the surveyed areas. By 2013, 85% of survey respondents noted persistent problems. A majority characterized their call completion problems as serious or chronic. These results have been documented and reported to the FCC. It's important for consumers to know that the long-distance or wireless company they have selected is not the only company that touches their call from beginning to end. Call paths are complex. The chosen company may be turning traffic over to another underlying least-cost provider to carry its traffic. Consumers and local telephone companies face a difficult task in trying to identify which long-distance or intermediate company is the culprit for dropped calls or degraded quality. These calling problems originate outside the local telephone networks. The calls glide from one company's network to a second, and often a third, and a fourth, and frequently do not even reach the local telephone company. Your local phone company may be able to help you identify call completion problems, but most likely these problems cannot be fixed by your local company. The FCC has a form on its website for consumers to file complaints regarding call completion. It's at www.fcc.gov/complaints. The form asks that, if possible, you identify the long distance or wireless company of the person who made the call. Unfortunately, most consumers are not able to provide this information. The FCC needs to step up and take measures that will stop this serious problem. Currently, the FCC does not register or oversee regulatory compliance for underlying intermediate providers or routers of calls. It needs to. This is Bonnie Larang, General Manager of MITS, Montana Independent Telecommunications Systems. Thanks for listening.
Bonnie Larang is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates Carney. Thanks for listening. And please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.